is the Norma Jean Calderwood University Professor in Islamic and Asian Art at Boston College and specializes in the arts of the book in the early modern Islamic world. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starved to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition, but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, July 28th at 10 a.m. on 90.7 KBOO FM. If you love animals, and especially dogs, don't miss it. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
Welcome to Policy for the People, a show that explores the public policies that can lift up all Oregonians. This show is a collaboration between KMUZ Radio and the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I am your host, Juan Carlos Ordóñez. On July 1, workers in one region of Oregon achieved what once seemed an inspired goal. The minimum wage in the Portland metro area, not in the rest of the state, crossed the $15 an hour level. But this milestone arrived more than a decade after workers across the country began demanding a $15 an hour minimum wage. In this episode of Policy for the People, we examine how much actual progress Oregon's minimum wage workers have made since the legislature established a new minimum wage law 7 years ago. We finish the show with a brief discussion on a big win for Oregon's most vulnerable children, the legislature's decision to establish the Oregon Kids Credit, a new state child tax credit. Stay tuned.
Fast food workers took to the streets this morning to strike in dozens of cities from Hartford, Connecticut to Memphis, Tennessee, and all the way to Berkeley, California.
More than a decade ago, workers across the nation earning low wages began agitating for a new minimum wage of $15 an hour. The Oregon legislature eventually responded, establishing a new minimum wage law in 2016. To understand the impact of this new minimum wage law, I spoke with my colleague from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Janet Bauer. Janet is the center's director of policy research. Janet, on July 1, the minimum wage went up in Oregon, and we're going to get to the details of that increase in a moment. But let me begin by asking, what's the purpose of the minimum wage, and is Oregon's minimum wage fulfilling that purpose?
Yeah, so Oregon has had a minimum wage for over 100 years, and we were one of the first states to create a minimum wage. And The purpose of having a minimum wage is to make sure that workers have a standard of living that protects their health and their well-being. In fact, the goal of the federal minimum wage when it was created in 1938 was to support the economy by making sure that workers could work and were available on an ongoing basis. Oregon's minimum wage helps achieve those goals by having a minimum wage standard. But at the same time, Oregon's minimum wage isn't yet quite strong enough to provide a standard of living where workers can consistently sustain themselves.
So as I mentioned before, the minimum wage went up this month here in Oregon. So where does the wage floor stand now after this increase that just took effect?
Well, the answer to that depends on where you live in Oregon and where you work. Our current minimum wage, it was created in 2016, and it substantially increased our minimum wage in steps over a period of 7 years. The amount of the increases were different depending on where the business was located. The bill created three minimum wage tiers. So there's a standard rate for the state as a whole, and there's another rate that is a bit higher for people in the Portland metro area, and it's a bit lower in rural areas. So back to your question, the minimum wage increased by 5 or 6% from last year, depending on the tier. Just to give you the exact numbers, the standard rate as of July 2023 is $14.20 an hour. In the Portland metro area, it is $15.45 an hour. And in rural counties, it is $13.20 an hour.
How does Oregon's minimum wage then compare to the federal minimum wage? Because we also have a federal floor. So how does it compare to the federal minimum wage as well as that of other states?
Well, Oregon's minimum wage is higher than the federal minimum wage. The federal minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 since 2010, which is an amount far from enough for people in Oregon to live on. There are 30 states and the District of Columbia that are like Oregon, with a minimum wage above the federal minimum. And of those, eight of them are higher than Oregon. And that, by the way, includes California and Washington.
We have three different minimum wage levels depending on where you are employed. How did this structure come about? Can you fill us in a little bit more about that history of how this new minimum wage came into effect?
Well, it is interesting. Lawmakers who are working on the bill, they were struggling to agree on the exact level of those six yearly increases. Some people wanted it higher so that workers in the Portland area, where housing costs and other things are higher, so they could survive. And there are others who are concerned that that level would be just too much for other areas of the state where costs were not as high. So ultimately, lawmakers compromised. They agreed on the solution to create the three tiers to take into account this regional variation in the cost of living.
So back in 2016, when the new minimum wage law went into effect, Oregon's wage floor stood at $9.25 per hour. Today, it's significantly higher, even above $15 an hour in the Portland metro area. But just looking at dollar figures alone doesn't tell the whole story, right?
You know, whether a wage is enough to support a family depends on how much the basics cost, like, you know, housing and food. So we always need to be mindful of inflation. Those costs increase over time. You know, for example, $15 an hour in 2016, when the bill was passed, has quite a bit different meaning than that $15 today. it just that those dollars just don't go as far. And that's in part why it's really important that minimum wage levels are tied to inflation so that workers don't fall behind.
So if we take into account the rising cost of living, how much progress have Oregon's lowest paid workers actually made since the new minimum wage law came into effect a few years back?
Mm-hmm. Well, workers have certainly made progress due to the law. And let's look, you know, for example, looking at workers in the standard areas of the state, meaning outside the Portland area, excluding most rural parts, the wage rose by 23%, even taking into account that inflation we just were talking about. So to state that another way, those workers had 23% more purchasing power after the 6 years of increases. And workers in other areas made real gains as well. One thing I want to note, though, is that the increases outlined in the law didn't anticipate the jumps in inflation that we've seen recently. So it's clear that lawmakers intended for workers to have more purchasing power today than they actually have ended up with.
And speaking of inflation, the minimum wage increase that just took effect, it is an increase that only tracks inflation. This is the first year when the Oregon's minimum wage pivots to a new way of calculating the minimum wage.
Yeah, that's right. So the original law bumped up the minimum wage, but the intent was to do much more than inflation because workers were so far behind in being able to meet their needs. The increases took place over 7 years. They bumped up modestly each year. And at the end of that period, the minimum wage went back to increasing each year based on the rate of inflation. So that's where we are now, actually. So between 2022 and 23, the minimum has increased just by inflation, which is about 5%. I should note that although these minimum wage increases are tied to inflation now in Oregon, we just need to be mindful that it simply is helping workers maintain their standing. They're not really making any progress. They're not falling behind, but they're not making any progress. They're just keeping up. And that's all that's going to be happening now, according to the law.
So let's switch focus here and talk about the workers who make minimum wage. How many workers in our state get paid the minimum wage, and who are they?
Yeah, well, there are about 92,000 jobs in Oregon that pay the minimum wage. That figure is for the jobs. In terms of the number of workers, there's probably slightly fewer than that, since some of those workers may work two minimum wage jobs. But the fact is that we're talking about tens of thousands of workers in Oregon. Most are in their prime working years. Some are older, though, and more than one in 10 are 55 years or older. There are parents who are working for minimum wage. One out of every four minimum wage worker is a parent. The majority of them are women, and they are disproportionately workers of color. Most of them work full-time and year-round. And the last thing that I would say is that in terms of who these workers are, only about 7% of them are earning tips. So most are fully reliant on that base minimum wage.
So based on that description, it sounds like these are workers who work to take care of themselves and their families. These are not teenagers working summer jobs.
I think that's a really important point, that almost all minimum wage workers rely on that job to support themselves and their families. We're not talking about extra spending money. we're talking about being able to meet basic, you know, your fundamental needs.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Janet Bauer, Director of Policy Research at the Oregon Center for Public Policy, about how much progress Oregon's lowest paid workers have made since the new minimum wage law came into effect in 2016. When the minimum wage goes up, obviously it helps those workers who earn the minimum wage. But are there other benefits to having a strong minimum wage?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is that, remember I said that the minimum wage workers are disproportionately workers of color, and most are women. So raising their wages accomplishes shrinking those pay gaps that have been persistent in Oregon and across the country by race and gender. A higher minimum wage also has other important social impacts. So for instance, just looking at families, the research shows that minimum wage decreases teen pregnancy. It also decreases infant mortality and low birth weight. It helps prevent child mistreatment. And there's even evidence that it helps to curb premature death. I think the last thing that I'll say about impacts on families is that it helps people get the medical care that they need, and that may contribute to, you know, curbing premature death and other things. But turning to another group, there are clear benefits to businesses of a higher minimum wage. And one of the most important ones is lower employee turnover. This is really important because low-wage jobs are notorious for having very high turnover rates. And the benefits of having reduced turnover accrue to those businesses because turnover is quite costly. And by lowering those turnover rates and those costs, the savings to a business can be substantial. Some of the other ways in which a higher minimum wage helps businesses is that it increases how productive workers are. And that can be for a number of reasons. It can be based on their worker motivation and better morale, but also to the degree that the business is willing to invest in that worker to make them more productive. If that worker is going to be around and not walk out the door tomorrow, that employer is more likely to invest in their skills and helping them bring more value to the business. And then looking at even another level for the economy, a higher minimum wage increases economic activity. Workers have more money to spend. And by the way, giving lower wage workers more money in their paycheck means that those workers, because they are struggling to meet their basic needs, are very likely to spend that extra earnings quickly and to do it in their local economy. And for these reasons, a higher minimum wage can induce job growth.
What you're saying seems to go against the claim that you often hear against raising the minimum wage, which is that it'll lead to job losses because employers simply can't afford to pay people the higher wage, or because employers will decide to switch to automation, bring in robots to replace workers. Is there specific research on this point of the impact of a higher minimum wage on the job market?
Well, the question that you ask is one of the most intensely researched questions in social policy. You know, initially, economists assumed that jobs would be sacrificed with a higher minimum wage, but it actually turns out, after extensive research for a number of years, that this just simply isn't the case. And there's now consensus amongst economists that there's little to no negative impact on jobs as a result of an increased minimum wage. One thing I want to also mention is that we have seen recent research that has shown that increasing the minimum wage actually produces jobs and generates jobs. So it's in fact to the contrary of what economists had originally thought when we were first debating this. So really looking under the hood on how minimum wages work in reality has been really revealing and shows multiple positive impacts, including increasing the number of jobs in the job market.
So there are broader economic benefits to a strong minimum wage. There are other benefits to the health and well-being of workers from a strong minimum wage. And we also, as you said, Oregon's lowest paid workers have seen real progress in recent years. All that said, how does Oregon's minimum wage do in terms of ensuring that the lowest paid workers actually make ends meet? Does the current wage level, wage floor here in Oregon, allow workers to care for themselves and their families?
As I said earlier, minimum wage workers certainly have made a lot of progress because of Oregon's recent minimum wage law. But the reality is that we need to do more. And workers were far from being able to make ends meet before the law was enacted. And in fact, they're still struggling. We looked at an index that measures what it takes for families of various sizes to survive, meaning to just meet their basic needs without any of the extras or without even investing for things like an education to get ahead, but we're just talking about the bare minimum. So the index that we looked at is a special one that was created by the United Way, and it's called ALICE, and it stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed. And it is a great tool that measures the basic needs in every county in Oregon. So we're talking about housing, we're talking about food, transportation, and even childcare costs for families that have children. It's been a really important tool to look at what does it take to survive. And so that's the measure that we've been using to determine what kind of how a minimum wage enables a household to survive by looking at what it would take per hour for that person, for that household to afford all of those basics. And so what that ALICE index shows is that for a single person with one child, that person would need to be earning $21 an hour to be able to survive in Oregon. And so that's far more than the highest minimum wage that we have now in 2023, which is just above $15 an hour. So we do have a ways to go.
Janet, given all that we've discussed, what do you think the lesson is for Oregon policymakers?
Yeah, there are a few important lessons. The first is that boosting the minimum wage is effective. It's effective in improving the living standards for our workers. Another thing is that you need to increase it to a level that accounts for the real costs that families are facing. And the third thing I would say is that it helps businesses and it also helps the economy. So, you know, I think the bottom line is that the minimum wage increases that started in 2016 and ended last year have meant real progress for Oregon workers, and we just need to keep at this. Now is the time for lawmakers to take another look at our wage floor. They need to talk about continuing to boost the minimum wage so that workers are able to sustain themselves. Now, the job is just not done until all Oregon families can enjoy economic security.
That was Janet Bauer, the Oregon Center for Public Policy's Director of Policy Research, discussing the progress and shortcomings of Oregon's minimum wage law. As promised, we finished the show with good news. On the last day of the Oregon legislative session, with near unanimous support in both the House and Senate, lawmakers voted to establish a new child tax credit, the Oregon Kids Credit. I spoke with my colleague Tyler McInnes, policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, about what the creation of the Oregon Kids Credit means for families and our state. So Tyler, what does the enactment of the Oregon Kids Credit mean for Oregon families and more broadly for our state?
Well, fundamentally, the Oregon Kids Credit being passed by the legislature means much needed added economic security for the most vulnerable families in our state. The Oregon Kids Credit will put extra money into the pockets of the lowest income families who are currently struggling with the rising cost of raising young children. And we know from the research that policies like the Oregon Kids Credit have a long list of positive impacts, whether it's the ability to catch up on debt or, you know, maintain housing, being able to pay the rent, those sorts of things, reduce stress. There's a long literature that just goes to show that when you give money to families who are struggling to make ends meet, that extra money in their budgets goes a long way to just helping them be more economically secure and healthier. And so in the short term, there are going to be a lot of Oregon families who are a little bit more economically secure and better off. But in the long term, that has all sorts of benefits to our state in terms of savings in other systems. So by investing in the families in greatest need, by investing in children in their early years, we're setting ourselves up for long-term success in Oregon.
So how is this child tax credit structured? What families will benefit from it?
So the Oregon Kids Credit provides a $1,000 fully refundable tax credit for every child age 0 to 5. The full credit is available to families who make between $0 and $25,000 in adjusted gross income. And eligibility begins to phase out at that point. So families earning up to $30,000 a year can receive a partial credit before eligibility fully phases out. So for example, a single parent who earns $20,000 a year, who has a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old at home, they'd be eligible for a $2,000 Oregon Kids Credit. That's a 10% bump in their income. And that means that that family's better able to keep food on the table, keep utility bills paid and up to date, or buy supplies like diapers for their young kids.
How many children do we expect will benefit as a result of the Oregon Kids Credit?
We've estimated that about 55,000 Oregon children would be eligible for the Oregon Kids Credit as it's been passed. Children in every Oregon county would benefit from the Oregon Kids Credit, disproportionately in rural communities. And the Kids Credit will disproportionately benefit Black, Indigenous, and Latino children in particular, which will help ease the racial disparities that we see persistent in outcomes for children in our state.
And when will the tax credit go into effect?
The tax credit goes into effect this tax year. So when folks are starting to file their taxes in early 2024, they can start to receive this help right away. That's really critical and something we were really glad to see, that we're getting dollars out the door quickly because families are struggling to make ends meet today.
So assuming that the governor signs the legislation and the Oregon Kids Credit becomes law, what comes next?
Well, the first and foremost, we need to get the word out and make sure that people know that they may be eligible for a kids credit in this current tax year. So we want to make sure that any family that's eligible to receive the Oregon Kids Credit is claiming it in early 2024 when they're able to file their taxes. But as far as future work around the credit, we'd love to see the Oregon Kids Credit expanded to include more families, so that looks at things of including older children, not just children ages 0 to 5. increasing the income eligibility so that families who are still struggling to get by, say families making $40,000, $50,000 a year, are also able to claim the Oregon Kids Credit. And importantly, we really want to see this be a foundation of what cash policy could look like in the state. We think that ensuring that all Oregonians have a baseline standard of living and dignity through an income floor in the future is something that we really want to work towards, something like a guaranteed income in Oregon. So anything we can do to show that cash policies can work will help us in that long-term work of ensuring that all Oregonians have the income they need to get by.
Well, Tyler, thank you very much.
Thanks, Juan Carlos.
And thank you for listening to Policy for the People. We will see you next
time.
Good morning and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. This week, Jeff Godsell revisits the early Couple on the Run film noir, Gun Crazy, from 1950. And then we reprise Britta Gordon's review of Christian Petzold's Undine from 2021. But first, Matthew of KBOO's monthly bedtime story program, Gremlin Time, looks at the Hong Kong action film, My Young Auntie.
Among the many nice box sets of movies that are out nowadays comes a nice collection from Arrow Films and Celestial Pictures, which collects the great classic movies of the Shaw Brothers Studios in Hong Kong up until 1985. And just out from them is Volume 2 of their collection, entitled Shaw Scope, Volume 2. The title, of course, referring to the widescreen format that the Shaw Brothers produced their movies in. At this time. Within it, I came across a movie that I had read about